Blog Talk Radio.
Tuning in to Movie Geeks United, everybody. Tonight we have Kelly McGillis, Danielle Harris, and Connor Piallo from the new film Stakeland, which opens in limited release, and it's available on IFC On Demand, I believe, too. Opens this Friday, April 22nd. Jerry, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. So, that is available on demand? That's pretty cool.
Unless I just made that up,
okay.
Which is quite possible.
All right. No, but that's pretty cool. It sounds like a really interesting film, so it's a great cast. So I definitely want to check that out.
Speaking of on-demand, man, I thought there'd be more demand for Scream 4, but apparently there wasn't.
So I'm watching it. You know how bad I don't remember any of them? I kept thinking, like, the David Arquette was his character from Scary Movie, so Officer Doofy. So I'm like, yeah, it's Officer Doofy, and then all I could think of is the scene in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back where they make fun of that, where Wes Craven's in it. And that's all I could think of during the movie. It's not a bad, it's a fun movie, but I mean, I don't think there was a demand for a fourth one, let alone a fifth and sixth one that Kevin Williamson was talking about in EW last week.
Well, man, I don't remember anything about the third one. And the third one was the highest grossing opening weekend in the franchise history. So I thought that this would do a lot better. And actually, I thought that this was the best one since the original. I had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, it's a fun... I can't take it too seriously, you know? So, I mean...
Well, yeah, it's not Schindler's List, but you're going to have a good time watching a Scream movie.
Let me ask you this, though. Did you ever think that they were scared? Like, they were actually... I always look at the first one, and the ones is like, really, like, sort of in jokes almost. Like, just jokes within jokes about the horror genre, about Wes Craven's career. More specifically, so I always look at them more as comedies than anything else. I mean, I don't really look at them as like slasher films at all. I know a lot of people look at like would qualify as horror, but I have to say they're funnier than. I mean, I laughed more during this movie than I did during more comedies recently. So, I mean, laughed out loud because I thought, oh, that's funny.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't really get scared much by these kinds of movies.
No.
But, yeah, it's obviously going for humor above all other things. But, you know, the Rio, the animated family movie, the highest grossing weekend of the year.
Yeah, well.
Over $40 million. So it's fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. There's just a limit to how much of these animated movies. And this one's in 3D, right, as well? Like,
oh, I'm sure, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I just about, you know, as much as I like Anne Hathaway, I just really wasn't interested. And Jesse Eisenberg, for that matter. I just really couldn't muster up the courage to go sit through this one.
Yeah. You see anything else interesting this past
week?
Though?
We watched Super yesterday on demand.
Oh.
I thought that was pretty cool. I liked that a lot.
Was it Super?
It was Super. It was pretty funny. I enjoyed it. It was a little bit different than I thought it would be, but it's really interesting. All these movies like Kick-Ass and Defender and Special and, I guess, Mystery. It reminded me somewhat of Mystery Men, too, from that was like 11 years ago. But it was cool. I really enjoyed it. I like James Gunn. I liked everyone in the cast was great. And there's a lot. And I was looking specifically out for Lloyd Kaufman and found him. So
You did see him? You did catch him?
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. I hear it becomes really twisted.
It is. Not as violent, let's say, as Kick-Ass or anything, but it definitely has its moments where it's like, holy shit. It's James Gunn for you. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, I saw a couple of movies, older movies, this mm-hmm. past week. Oh, I guess the big one that I got to talk about. It's become this cult title.
Mm-hmm. I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, Entertainment Weekly did a big write-up on it, and people have been talking about it. It was released in 2002,
mm-hmm.
but it's like just now reached cult status, I guess, somehow. Mm-hmm. And that is The Room. Tommy Wiseau writes, directs, stars in it.
Yeah,
I had never seen it until a couple of days ago.
Right.
So I had nothing to talk about. But, man.
What did you think? Do you think it's worth this cult status, or...
I do, yeah. I mean, it's obviously bad.
Oh, it's beyond bad. I mean, it's just, but I don't even think it's bad enough to,
I absolutely do.
It's bad, but I mean, it's just nothing that I want to go back and watch again. I mean.
Oh, I've seen it twice in the past week.
Oh, God.
What fascinates me is I don't know what's up with that guy. I think he's absolutely sincere that he didn't set out to make a bad movie, but
true.
There are behind-the-scenes clips
mm-hmm.
on the DVD, and crew members are laughing in the middle of takes. You see them, and every time they enter a room, and they're like, "Oh hi, Diddy. Oh hi, Mark." There's so much like delicious stuff in it that makes me laugh, and the Cinemax softcore kind of scenes that they intersperse into it, like they have every 15 minute kind of quota. And you know, the lapses in narrative kind of, you know, that don't make any sense.
None whatsoever.
He says, give me advice. You're a psychologist. And then 5 minutes later, it's like, you're always psychoanalyzing everything. And he hit me. He's a terrible person. And then 5 minutes later, he's a good man. It strikes me as like maybe Tommy Wiseau was dumped by this woman,
mm-hmm.
and he set out to make a movie where he was the martyr.
Wow.
In a relationship. That's what I'm reading into it.
Yeah.
And is something mentally wrong? I mean, is he deficient in some way?
I don't know. You're going. No, seriously, you have to kind of question
that. So somehow he comes up with this money,
mm-hmm.
and he hires a crew, and obviously this is a job for them.
Mm-hmm.
They're working, they're being paid.
Right.
And he shoots both simultaneously on 35mm film and high-definition video in 2002.
Right.
Because he claims that there wasn't enough information on the quality of digital at that time compared to 35mm, which is absolutely asinine. So he shoots them both side by side, both cameras, side by side. He's so proud of this unit he has. Meanwhile, it's the most ridiculous idea I've ever heard of in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And the acting is like horrendous, led by him. It's funny. I watched it with my mouth wide open. The first time.
The
second time, I just laughed all the way through it.
Yeah, I couldn't. I didn't feel like watching it again. Once was enough. I don't know how much time I have left on this earth, but I just didn't really feel like going back into it. But I remember seeing trailers for this film while I lived in Los Angeles.
Right.
I remember before it come out, before it was going to come out that summer of 2003. So I remember like actually seeing trailers for this in the theater.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you kind of feel sorry for him, and then there's an interview with him on the disc too. Honestly, as soon as I finished watching this movie, I sent an interview request out to him
because
I want to know about this film. So, but there's an interview in there, and the interview is badly done. The interview is dubbed. There's really bad dubbing in his answers in the interview.
Oh God.
Like, even the interview, just one shot of him answering questions is Ed Wood-like.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's great stuff. Anyway, so that was the best of the worst movies I saw last week.
I like the best of the worst.
I also saw Rabbit Hole, which I like very much.
Yeah, that was good, yeah.
And Nicole Kidman was, you know, and that's another movie, because the Room, which there's no reason why that movie should be called The Room, too. Maybe that's another story, I guess. But The Room was actually first written as a stage play, according to this guy. Tommy Wiseau.
Yeah.
And he actually said, the funniest thing is he wants to write a book about the difference between high definition and 35 millimeter, because that hasn't been done to death the past decade.
Oh, of course not. Yeah, I mean.
And that maintains its kind of stagey feel where everybody walks in and out and hits a mark and says hi and
right.
Then says, I don't want to talk about it, I got to go, and walks out.
Yeah.
the Rabbit Hole is also based on a stage play, and you wouldn't know it. I mean, it's not stagey in the least for me.
Not at all, yeah. Not
yeah.
at all.
And very good performances, a nice little character piece. I also saw the Kennedys miniseries, most of it.
How is that?
About 5 hours of it I watch.
Wow.
There's nothing real controversial in it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all the stuff about the medication and the women, that's all in there.
But we've known that for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
yeah, but it it doesn't try to rosy it up. But
mm-hmm.
there's nothing invented, really,
mm-hmm.
to decimate his image.
Mm-hmm.
Greg Kinnear kind of, I mean, he's fine.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't really come across. Robert Kennedy, Barry Pepper is the one that gives the great performance in the movie.
Oh.
And it's essentially his movie. And it's his movie, and it's Tom Wilkinson's movie. That's Joe
Wilkinson
Kennedy.
He plays Joe?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, okay.
And Greg Kinnear's kind of just, you know, a face in the background for the most part. Those are the only characters that really pop out.
Mm-hmm.
It's well done, I guess. It feels like a TV movie. I mean, it feels like it was made 15 years ago for TV. It's got that kind of stench to it.
Yeah. Remember that
so
one? Martin Sheen?
Doesn't feel like HBO. Yeah, the Martin Sheen was good.
Yeah, that was in the mid-80s, I think, The Missiles of October or something. I don't remember exactly which one, but I remember there's one we watched with Martin Sheen in the mid. Well,
no, it was called Kennedy. I mean, he did a mini series about Kennedy's life, and Blair mm-hmm. Brown played Jacqueline.
Right.
In it. I mean, this was the early 80s, but he's played Kennedy, I think, a couple of times, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And it also inspired me throughout the day to imitate Kennedy, the Kennedys. Like, I couldn't stop walking around the apartment going, arrah! Because that's how they start every sentence. Arrah! Well, it doesn't make any sense, but that's what I did all day, was imitate
well, that's,
Kennedy.
Well, that's good, I guess. Wait, let me ask you this, though. Is there an obvious right-wing slant on it?
No, I mean, not
okay.
really.
Not like something like Atlas Shrugged or something like that, then.
I mean, I would have been very interested in seeing a right wing slanted portrayal of the Kennedys.
Mm-hmm.
But,
it's not this one.
Yeah, it's not noticeably so for me.
Okay, I was just curious because that's what all the thing was about. You know, they thought that. This
yeah.
was, so.
I mean, I didn't. I never once thought, you know, how dare they? They're slinging mud and all that kind of stuff.
I didn't get that
me.
Either. When this was first coming, when this first came out, you know, I didn't. But my whole thing is, what more is there? We know so much.
Right.
You know, I didn't know what else they were going to add.
Well, I mean, the only thing really, when it's been covered to death as the Kennedy family has, is to latch on to how they choose to portray certain events and the performances.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the performances are okay and. It's confidently enough done. But Barry Pepper deserves a nomination come Emmy time, I think, if they don't overlook the movie altogether.
Right.
What else I see? Fair Game, which is okay.
It's good. It's better than I thought it would be, but I think I prefer the other one, actually, to it. Nothing But the Truth, I actually think, is a better film.
Oh, yeah. Me too.
I really think that's the better of the two.
Me too. And Doug Liman, I mean, I understand why you go to him to kind of thriller up talky movies,
mm-hmm.
you know, because they want this movie to play like a thriller.
Mm-hmm.
But I think an equally thrilling movie that doesn't try to pull tricks to pretend like it's a thriller is Recount. And
right.
that it's fast-paced, it's just people talking back and forth. I mean, Fair Game probably would have been better handled that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I never thought
All
that
right.
Jay Roach could have done a better
yeah.
job than Doug Liman, but it's possible.
I think The Fair Game has the same problem that Green Zone has. It's like, that because it's the same period. It's not so much it's too soon. It's just it's so recent. It's all in our minds and everything. It's like I almost hate to say it. Green Zone and fair game, especially outside the Beltway. No one really cares about this. I mean, that's a tough sell. That movie, I always felt, was a tough sell. The further you get away, actually, from the actual events, people are like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know,
but
it is.
A movie can make you care.
Oh, yeah, a movie
if it's
can.
Good.
It's not this one, though.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, namely, the performances don't even come off. I mean, and you get very little feeling for their relationship, by and large.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. But what are the other movies I've seen? I've seen so many, Jerry. So many. Oh, hi, Jerry.
Oh, hi, Jamie.
Tron Legacy, I watched that.
What did you think of that?
The art direction's great. Set design, everything's great. I mean, that's one cool-looking movie.
Yeah.
And sounding movie, too.
Yeah, the sounds, yeah, but all that's good. But when you have to start out with that, especially you, that's a bad sign.
Oh, I could give a shit about anything that happens in it, but the actual movie looks phenomenal. And
right.
I'm pretty sure it was greatly influenced by Kubrick. Because if you notice Jeff Bridges, the older Jeff Bridges, his home, I mean, that looks exactly like the set at the end of 2001.
Yeah, it does. You're absolutely right.
The white floors and all that kind of stuff, and,
mm-hmm.
Which is a good model to have. But it's
yeah.
a sleek, sleek-looking movie. You know, I enjoy it. I enjoyed it for what it was.
Yeah, there wasn't much. I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, there wasn't, you know, all these people saying, well, you know, what you need? I don't go into a movie like that expecting a lot, so, you know, you take
yeah.
I don't. Just there's never was the I don't know it's hard to go into a lot of these things expecting a lot these days but
it did well. I mean, it performed
yeah.
well.
Yeah, I mean, there's
and I wish I
would have
seen it
one.
In the theater, you know.
Yeah.
It would have been nice to see in the theater,
right.
To be surrounded by that sound and that vision,
mm-hmm.
and just shut my brain off since there's nothing else going on screen. But there's a lot of like religious overtones in it too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Keeps God and that kind of thing. And I don't know. Mildred Pierce was great. One of the best things I've seen on TV. And my favorite movie of the year so far.
Really? Okay. All right.
Yeah, yeah. The miniseries is fantastic. And Kate Winslet, she's all those year-end awards, she's got them bagged up for Mildred Pierce.
Yeah,
I think
everyone on that has it sewn up.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary movie. And it's the one Todd Haynes movie I've written that doesn't feel like an experiment. I mean, Far From Heaven comes closest, but this one succeeds all the way. I mean, because he's an experimental kind of filmmaker.
Yeah, oh, he is from the very beginning. He's always been. But you're right. I guess this is the closest thing. This and Far From Heaven are the closest that don't. Do you think Safe is an experimental film?
You know, I've seen Safe once.
Okay.
And I really didn't like it when I saw it.
It was a hard film
to
get into.
I never returned to it.
It's a hard film to get into. It's not easy. But though you definitely would think that the Julianne Moore character in that and Far From Heaven and Kate Winslet's Mildred Pierce have a lot in common.
Right. I mean, I would watch it again, but I'm afraid of all the germs that are on the DVD. And this itself is an experiment for Todd Haynes, too, Mildred Pierce. Let's see if I can do a five-hour melodrama.
Right.
Like a throwback melodrama. But it produces genuine emotion, and it's honest. You know, a lot of the experimental films are not honest.
Mm-hmm.
They're just exercises. But this one transcends that. So check that one out if you haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, it should be if you have it should be on the HBO on demand if you yeah, so
mm-hmm.
and they'll be repeating it constantly, I'm sure, on the other HBO
yeah.
channels.
So tonight we're going to talk with the talents involved in the new film Stakeland. Starting with Kelly McGillis, who we all know and love from Top Gun, the accused
witness.
What's the other
witness?
That was her first big movie.
That was,
yeah.
That, and I always forget The Accused. I was thinking, well, yeah, The Accused is a good one, yeah.
She's actually, in this interview, she talks a little bit about what drew her to a horror film, which is her first, but not her last. It's
right.
a genre that she doesn't like.
Mm-hmm.
And also a little bit about her past career. Kind of opens up when she says, well, the difference between then and now is that I used to be famous. And so we talk a little bit about fame.
Mm-hmm.
So here's Kelly McGillis. The movie Stake Land opens up in limited release this Friday, April 22nd. Here's Kelly. I read that you normally don't like these kinds of films, so whatever possessed you to do one?
Well, because they called me and it shot down the road for me and I could visit with friends and stay with friends and they paid me a little money and it was fun and I got to go back to where I used to live and visit a bunch of people. So, and then it turned out that I really adored working with Jimmy Mickle and Nick and Connor and everybody. It was just really, it was really fun. I'm really glad that I did it. But no, I have never seen a horror movie save when I was about 8 years old, and that was the first one and the last one I ever watched.
Oh, wow. So, but what is the environment on, because it's a, you said you love the people you worked with, but is there a different kind of chemistry when you're working on this type of material in terms of the tone of the set at all?
No, I don't think so. I really think that that is something that just either works or doesn't work. It doesn't really
mm-hmm.
matter what the venue is, you know, and I just really think that everybody on this project really was just incredibly wonderful because they really were passionate about what they were doing. These are all people, I guess, who know about that genre,
mm-hmm.
not like me, and they were really all into that part, and I just thought it was very sweet. I'm like, oh, how cute.
Do you find that a lot in independent films that you work on now, that there is that kind of passion involved?
Yes, I do, actually. I mean, I think that, yes. Yes, I think that there's a hunger there, and I think that there is a drive there, and that I guess people just don't take things for granted, which I really like.
Mm. And what was it that appealed to you about the role of Sister? What did you enjoy playing in that character?
Oh, I don't know if there was any one thing. I just kind of was, I was more intrigued by the whole story, the apocalyptic kind of theme
mm-hmm.
of the piece itself. That's what interested me at first. And then I think secondly, the character I just thought was interesting because just somebody grappling with there, what is my meaning?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that that's kind of a, I think that's a universal theme. I think that's something that every human being grapples with. Why am I here? What is the meaning of it all? And, you know, I just think that that was interesting to me.
Yeah. So, but I take it that you've, I mean, you haven't seen a horror movie since you were 8 years old, but I take it you've seen this one.
No, I haven't.
You haven't seen this one,
no.
Really?
Yeah, not really. I
oh.
tried to. I tried to, and then I left. I said I don't like being upset. I like sleeping well at night, and I like having happy dreams. So I really just have no desire to sit through a movie that's going to make me feel icky.
Okay. So I was going to ask you if you the audience reaction to it, but apparently you're not sure of the audience reaction.
Yeah, I'm not the one you want to ask that of.
Even when you're doing it though, and this goes for any movie that you do, can you feel that it's working, or are you never quite sure?
I don't know, because this is the deal here, that as an actor, I do what I do when I'm doing it with the director, the camera, the other actors, and I have my timing that I do, my rhythm, my dance, that my musical piece for that moment. And then mm-hmm. that music goes away and goes into a dark little room or on a computer or somebody with somebody else, and that music is re-edited by somebody else, and the rhythms and the timing becomes a wee bit different depending on what you know, the images and all that stuff, the story is, the feelings, all that, that that director, editor want to create at that moment. So it changes. It changes drastically. And with that, I never know.
Yeah. There's so many other kind of variables involved in it, so.
Yes, and I think that, I mean, one of the things about doing theater and why I go back to doing theater is because you're more in control of the music of the piece night to night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once I do my job on a movie, I'm not in control anymore of what that
yeah.
musical piece will look like.
Does it feel like you, because you do go back to the stage often, does it feel any more or less challenging than your film work?
No, it's just challenging in a different way, you know, and I mean, it's a different medium, so it's just different. I can't really compare it because in doing a theater piece, you're doing it new and different every single night because that audience that comes in is a character in the play every single night, and that is a different crowd every night, so... What's exciting about that to me is that it's absolutely different every time you do it.
Mm-hmm.
It can never be the same. And that shared experience with that group of people will be that one experience that you share forever and always.
Yeah.
Whereas in film, it's stuck there forever.
Yeah, yeah. And in theater, I mean, it's actually a living thing. I mean, it's live theater, obviously.
Yeah.
So tell me about your... career, this breadth of your career, and if acting means something different to you now, if it gives you a kind of different charge now than when you started.
Well, certainly it does, and I certainly would hope so after, I don't know, how long have I been doing it, 30 years, something?
Yeah.
Ask me that question again.
If acting means something different to you now, the joy you get from it.
Well, yes, it does mean something very different to me now. I don't know. It's hard to explain. You've really stumped me with this question because I think when I was starting out, I was very naive. I was very... It was so much more important than it is today to me. And it doesn't mean that it's not important, if that makes any sense. It's just that I thought it was earth-shattering, and it truly isn't. that's a really... We could talk about that for 2 hours. Today, I look at it in a way that it's a part of my creativity, my creative self, my expressive self. When I was younger, it was the be-all and the end-all of my existence, and today it is not. It's an aspect
right.
of me. It's a part of me, and it's a part that I love and cherish about me, and I honor and respect about me, but it doesn't define me, and if it's crappy and doesn't work out, or I don't get a gig, I'm not going to be suicidal about it.
Right, right.
You know,
right.
Before it was, I don't know, when I was younger, it was incredibly life or death to me. But I don't know if that's just youth or me. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Have you noticed that the, how has the business of it changed for you?
I don't know. You know, I used to be really famous and now I'm not. And I kind of like the not being. That's how it's changed.
Did you respond well to that kind of fame so
no.
early in your career?
No, I didn't. I drank a lot and took a lot of drugs. You know, it was very stressful for me because it's not what I wanted to be when I grew up. I didn't want to be famous. I wanted to be an actress, and
mm-hmm.
it was a real struggle for me. And I think in some ways that is still a struggle for me because I just think it's just not real. It's not
right.
real. But anyway, and that people sit running around saying they know you. Well, they don't know you. You can't possibly know me after talking to me on the phone for 15 minutes. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. a part of me that I've been willing to share with you, but I am multifaceted, and I'm probably more worthy than a 15-minute phone call in order to get to know, or, you know,
right.
a two-hour interview, or even a three-day interview. You can't really know somebody unless you experience their life with them, you know, walk in their life with them. So anyway, that whole weird thing is just weird to me.
Well, and that extends to the audiences as well, when they see you on screen and they feel like they know you. I mean, that has to be a very weird part of fame.
It is weird, and it is a disconnect for me, because people make assumptions about you that just really irritate the heck out of me, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but and that's okay. I can't control that, and I understand that, and I understand how people have to compartmentalize and kind of label things so that they can understand them. But it's also a frustrating part of it to me, because people are so much more than that, than what they do or what they're doing at the moment, or
right.
you know, it's where they've been, where they're going. I don't know. So I don't know. You've asked me a big philosophical question that I could talk about for hours with you.
Well, let me ask you an easier one. If you do get approached, which you certainly do and have your entire career, is it mostly about Top Gun?
Top Gun, Witness, or The Accused.
Mm-hmm. And Top Gun is coming up on, I mean, it's 25 years.
Oh, my God, don't say that. I feel so old.
And it's
okay.
amazing the life that this movie has had.
I know. Who would have thought? I thought it was a stupid cowboy movie in the sky, and look what happened. Shows you what I know.
Yeah. So you didn't have any expectations of the life this movie would carry?
No, none whatsoever.
Yeah. Before I let you go, I want to ask you about another one of your past films, and you just mentioned it, Witness, because Peter Weir is such an extraordinary director that I'm crazy
Amazing.
About.
Amazing.
I'd like to know about him and working with him. What was that
he
like?
He was just beautiful. That's all I can say. He's just a true artist, and I just was so blessed to be able to work with him right out of the gate.
Mm-hmm.
Holy cow. Who would have thunk that ever happened? And just a fantastic artist, and he taught me so much, and I'm so eternally grateful to him.
Yeah, that's a beautiful movie, like all of his films are.
Yes, I think he's just a wonderful, wonderful creative soul.
And do you have any other films in the pipeline?
I have a little movie coming out called The Innkeepers, so another horror movie. I don't know if it's a horror movie, it's a scary movie, but I have another same genre film that I've never seen, and I probably never will, but it's okay. So I have that one coming out.
Well, this is an exciting new direction for your career. You could become a scream queen. You could do horror films from now on.
I could. I don't know. Whatever pays the rent, I'm good with.
Okay, that was Kelly McGillis. She is starring in Stakeland, which opens up this weekend. Starting the 22nd. She's one of three actors from the film we'll be talking to tonight. Jerry,
wow,
you there?
That's awesome. That was really good.
Oh.
I like what she had to say. She said something very important here, not just for her, but for a lot of us. I mean, when she says you really can't know someone, or they make this assumption about actors and actresses or directors even, or musicians or whatever, artists, that you think you know them. I think we forget especially with the actors, is remember, they are acting. They are not playing themselves for the most part. I mean, I know we like to sometimes say, oh, the so-and-so just played it. No. So it's an awesome point she brings up, and something that really needs to be reiterated time and time again, because people do make these horrible assumptions that you're like the characters you play. You're a writer, and you are the people you write about to an extent.
And her most popular role, which is in Top Gun, is such kind of an anomaly to
mm-hmm.
everything else she's done on screen. You know,
yeah.
the blonde kind of sexpot girlfriend.
Right.
You know, and she hasn't really done any roles like that, that portion of her career even.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she played an Amish woman in Witness.
Yeah, that's right.
a defense attorney or an attorney in the accused. And yeah, so she, so that is interesting. And man, that kind of fame that hits you all at once, like
yeah.
what happened with Top Gun, has to be overwhelming.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, yeah. But that was a really good. That was a really good interview. You really got a lot of good stuff out of her in that amount of time. That's really.
Yeah, we didn't have much time with her. And I sounded groggy because maybe I shouldn't admit this, but I mean, I've had a cold all week, and I got up out of bed at 9 a.m. and I was interviewing her at 9:15.
You shouldn't have said
that. I know. I've just been sick all week, so I was staying in bed as long as possible.
Right.
That's my excuse.
All right. That's a good excuse, though. That is a good excuse.
And then she picked up the line, and I said, "Oh, hi, Kelly."
Oh, God.
Okay. So let's get to our next Stakeland interview, and then we'll we have three other interviews tonight. Starting with this one, and Danielle Harris a little bit later, and then Joan Benedict Steiger is going to talk about her life with actor Rod Steiger.
Cool.
At the end of the show. And then I've got a special treat with a piece of film score from an oldie but goodie.
Okay, cool.
I mean, it's not a classic oldie. It's from the 90s, I think.
Well, man, that's a lot of great stuff in the 90s.
Yeah, that was before a lot of our listeners were born.
Yeah,
so
it does scare me, though. That
doesn't it?
It does. It frightens me. Trust me, it frightens me.
It really does. Me too. Like, some of my favorite movies that I consider recent movies were released the year certain people were born that I end up talking to, and just, oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to the next interview.
This is too depressing. So Connor Paolo, he stars in Stakeland with Danielle Harris and Kelly McGillis. You might know him best for his role in Gossip Girl, but he's also worked with Oliver Stone a couple of times as the young Alexander.
Okay.
And of course, the movie Alexander, and one of Nicolas Cage's children and McLaughlin's children in World Trade Center.
Okay.
Which I almost picked up today. I was at a video store, and they had this special commemorative edition of World Trade Center, and it had a lot of Q&A stuff with Oliver Stone that I was interested in seeing, but not so much seeing the movie again. But
I'm curious what his process was during that movie. That would
be me too. I'd like to see behind the scenes stuff on it, but instead I got Year of the Dragon with commentary by Michael Cimino.
Oh, cool!
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Well, that's an awesome movie, though. Speaking of awesome movies, man, now that's an awesome movie.
Absolutely. Anyway, so Arenada Diaz, our trusted correspondent, spoke with Connor, and the beginning of this interview is pretty funny. So. And R-rated, so if any kids are around, please shoo them away. So here is Aaron with Connor.
Well, just to let you know, this is being pre-recorded. It'll air on Sunday, but feel free to speak your mind. No censoring, so you can say whatever you want.
You got it, motherfucker.
Okay, good. talk about this film, Stakeland. I guess, how did this project come to you, and what about it appealed to you?
This project came to me, I really like any other. I was just sent the script by way of the casting director, whose name is Sigda Miguel, who's been a good friend of mine for a while and a pretty avid supporter of mine. And I just read it, and that was all she wrote. Really, there was nothing. There was really nothing to be said after that. It was really just. So moving and so much something that I wanted to be a part of, that there was really no saying no to it.
And being on TV, you know, on Gossip Girl, I'm curious what part of that plays into when you pick a project of wanting to do something different from TV, because I know from television, you have to be very choosy in what you do in your downtime.
Give me the question again, then.
I'm curious on What part of being on a show like Gossip Girl plays into wanting to do something, trying to do something different?
I mean, personally, as an actor, I want every role I do to be a departure from the last one.
Right.
I don't know why you wouldn't. That's the whole thing. You know, that's the fun of this, is trying on different shoes and different hats and pants as well. I don't. There's no point in playing the same character over and over again. The point is to bring something new to people through a different shell, and not everybody's going to connect with one character, so you need to spread it around.
And I've talked to several actors who they juggle the TV and also theatrical. And I'm curious, one of the things that I've noticed when I've talked to certain actors, and I'm wondering if this is true for you, that the schedule of a television show is actually kind of a good training when you're on something that's relatively low budget and maybe has not a very expansive shooting schedule. Do you find that to be the case?
You mean just in fact of having to be on point right away? Absolutely. TV gets you used to not having a wealth of takes to play with, but honestly, every set is its own animal, and there are directors, someone like Clint Eastwood, who are not going to do 10 takes even if he's got 6 months to shoot. He likes to do it in one or two takes, so it really depends. And then, working with Oliver Stone or something, he'd do 15 takes even if he only had a week. You know what I mean? It depends on the director. It depends on their style. So, yes, television can prepare you for some things, can prepare you for a director who directs like he was directing a TV show, but that's it. I just did a pilot for ABC with Philip Noyce, and, that was a two-week shoot, but he shot it like it was a four-month multi-million-dollar film. You know, it really depends on the style that set is going to be at. So nothing really can prepare you for anything in this business. And if you're doing new and interesting things, then I think you should always be a little bit shocked and unprepared.
Yeah, and you mentioned the two of the big directors you worked with, and I was going to ask you about that, but since you brought them up, I'll ask them now. You were 12 and 13 when you did Mystic River and then your first of two Oliver Stone films.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious on two things. One, I'm curious on what that was, what was it like for, a 12-year-old? I don't know how, where you were working with those two,
mm-hmm.
icons, Clint Eastwood and Oliver Stone. But then also, what was it like going from, I got to assume that those two guys have very different temperaments on the set.
Night and day.
And so I was wondering what that was like, especially for a 12-year-old who's, you're trained and you've done other things, but I mean that must have been that was obviously stepping up your game going on those projects.
100%. I wish. In very many ways, I wish that I had been a little older when I worked with Eastwood. I mean, I got to work with Oliver again, so it kind of made up for it. But when I was actually 11 when I did Mystic River, and just at that age, you don't really have a philosophy about acting or you don't really have an opinion on your craft. You just kind of do it because hopefully it feels good and you really like it. But in terms of, a different point of view than other people or establishing how you are unique to your approach, that doesn't really exist in your psyche. But at the same time, because I was that age and because I was kind of at the more impressionable point in my life as a young man, as a boy, I'm so happy that I had that experience with both of them because it shaped how I conduct myself and what I look at being an actor as now. I mean, I credit, just because I spent 4 months with them, I credit Oliver Stone with most of my habits, most of my expectations, most of my etiquette and what I believe roles deserve out of you, and the time and research and commitment that I try to give everything I do. It comes mostly from the energy on Alexander and from what he expected of me. as a 13-year-old boy and as someone who was just kind of getting his sea legs as an actor, it's really informed the way I look at things now. Every director I've ever worked with, but those two, I'd say a little more so, only because I was middle age, where you really kind of start to have an idea of who you are.
Well, I'll just tell you a quick story. I was in New York last month, Oliver, at a special screening Oliver Stone had of his revised edition of Alexander in a theatrical setting. It was the first time being shown theatrically, his final cut of Alexander, and I got to talk to Oliver Stone a little and see the film on the big screen. And you know, I think it's a misunderstood film, particularly that, especially if you see that version. And I'm curious now, at this age, now you know you're obviously more of a veteran, and you probably do have some more philosophy on and ideas on what you want in your acting. But I'm curious now, thinking back about Alexander, you were 12, 13 when the film was coming out and when you made it, and obviously a 12, 13-year-old, I assume you're not too in tune with critical reaction and so forth, but I'm curious on what you, looking back on Alexander as an experience, what you think of that. I think it's a misunderstood film.
What I think about the reaction to it, or what I think of the film?
What do you think of the film?
As a kid, I understood where a lot of people came from. I also remember getting the strangest feeling when I was on that set, even as a kid, that Oliver knew too much about this, that he was so invested in Alexander as a person and understood it so deeply that it was almost one of those things where if you are presenting it to an audience, it can almost be a disservice to know so much about it, because it's harder for you to connect with people that don't know anything and don't have anything invested in it. But I don't think that's ever been his aim. I can't speak for him at all, but I think Mr. Stone is someone who makes movies because he believes that they need to be made, and he wants to make them. And I think that's why he's capable of brilliance when he is. I guess I understood where a lot of people were coming from. I think I was sorry that their disappointment or their anger over this, or I thought they focused on all the wrong things and wound up missing some of the truly spectacular things, because there are in that film, and they glossed over a lot of the performances there. And I think everyone in the film is honestly wonderful. I think Kilmer really gives one hell of a performance. I think Jolie is brilliant, and I think Colin is brilliant. And unfortunately, that all got swept under the rug because of his hairdo. And just what a silly thing to ignore a film because of. There were a lot of pacing problems, but, you know, that fight scene in India, I know most people didn't make it to that, but I think that's what Rodrigo did with that scene is among some of the coolest battle cinematography I've ever seen.
Right.
The reaction in terms of my involvement from critics was actually very favorable. So that was quite nice. And in a weird way, I think had people liked the movie more, they probably would have, I doubt they would have focused on me, only because they would have been getting accolades everywhere else. The fact that they didn't have very many nice things to say about the film as a whole, I think allowed them to lavish a little bit more praise on me, which was nice.
Well, I think the tide is turning, particularly at the screening that I attended of the final cut, and people really seem to respond to it. But to start wrapping this up, to get back to the film we're here to talk about, Stakeland, and I'll ask you this: what do you now that you're an adult now, and so you're more invested, I would think, in the films you make.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of this film, and what are you hoping audiences take away from it?
I honestly have never been more proud of anything I've ever done, ever. And I'm proud of everything I've done.
Mm-hmm.
But this, I believed in from the start, and to see it realized to a point where I am consistently moved by it, and consistently excited by it. And if I thought it sucked now, I wouldn't be here talking to you. You know what I mean?
Right.
I just would divorce myself from it. But I truly believe in this. I really hope people see it, because it's exciting and it's moving and it has something to say, and it's worth people's time. So my hope is you know, I could really give a shit about numbers or release spectrum, but I do give a shit about what that represents, and that represents viewership, I assume, and effect. And I just really hope that people make the time, you know, to take the hour and a half to experience the film, because I think it's a worthwhile experience.
Okay, that's Connor Paolo. He's the star of the new film Stakeland, opening up April 22nd. Also got some Oliver Stone tidbits in there.
Yeah, now that's a very good interview, and I think Aaron brings up a good point that he might very well be right that the tide is turning on Alexander if this new version, this new is to be believed. That's very possible, because, I mean, look at something like Heaven's Gate, reviled when it came out, but now it's reached the level of classic, if you will. People really hold that film in high regard now.
But do you think Alexander deserves another chance? Or
well,
did you only see it once?
I've seen it only the one time in the theater, and my back was killing me. But I won't lie to you. But having said that, if he really went, I don't know, because it brings up a good point, that it was pacing issues are a big problem with the film. It is not paced very well. Forget everything else. It's the pacing on a film of that magnitude has to be better than it was. Now, if he fixed that, maybe I would give it another shot. But do we know what the differences are? I mean, look at something like Kingdom of Heaven. Supposedly the director's cut of that is supposed to be incredible from the theatrical release. So I don't...
It's odd that adding 45 minutes or however much footage he added could help the pace.
Oh, wait. This isn't like what the Coen brothers did a couple of years ago where they the director's cut of Blood Simple where they made it shorter, actually?
No, I think this is long. I'm pretty sure this
God.
Is longer.
Oh, I didn't. Okay, wow, 45 minutes longer?
Yeah, it's probably a 3.5-hour movie, I think.
Oh.
I mean, it's an epic length. But who knows? I mean, sometimes narrative holes can be filled with this information, and it can make sense more and have you more invested in it, and therefore not feel so, you know, laboriously paced.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
Okay.
I mean, Aaron liked it, but then again, Aaron was in a theater watching it with Oliver Stone, and that can color your
true.
Your feelings.
No, of course.
Yeah.
That you're absolutely right.
Let's get to our last Stakeland interview, which is Danielle Harris, and then we'll talk a little bit about Sidney Lumet before going into our final interview for the night. Danielle Harris, of course, we all know her and love her from her work in the horror genre throughout her life, since she was a kid in Halloween 5, and then Rob Zombie's Halloween, and Stakeland is a big movie for her, and she's really, really proud of it. She's also been working with Adam Green lately, Hatchet 2, and possibly an upcoming Hatchet 3 that we talk to her about.
Oh, cool.
But here is Danielle.
Yeah, I think, you know, what I love, why I like watching Stakeland so much is because, you know, we kind of shot the movie sort of in sequence because of the seasons changing. So I think as people got to develop our relationships on set with each other and become friends and become a family, essentially. And I think that that really comes across on screen. It's not like, you know, any other movie where you're jumping in and you're starting on page 72 and then you go to 22 and then 40. And so we kind of shot in order a bit. And I think that you can see that a little bit. Like, I think it was like the second to last day was my favorite scene, which was where Belle's kind of had it, and she sits on that rock and says, like, I can't go anymore, go. And Mister picks her up and carries her. And, you know, I got to set that day, and I said, I think I'm going to kind of bust your balls a little bit. And Nick was like, oh, yeah, whatever, you know, you're going to bust my balls. And I said, well, I don't really know how I feel about this, because I don't have much dialogue in the movie. So... And as soon as I sat on the rock and did the whole thing, and Nick picked me up, I just couldn't get those words out of my mouth without crying every single time. And that, as an actor, you're like, oh my God, those organic moments that are kind of happy accidents. And I think that it's, I think you see that. And I cry every time I watch that scene. And there's only two or three lines. I mean, it's so simple. And then Nick started to cry. And I'm like, wow, like, that's the first time that you kind of see Mr. having a bit of heart, which you know is always there. And I think I was able to bring that out in him. And I think that was Belle's relationship with Mr. And that was, I think, my relationship with Nick. So I think it's really kind of obvious to the audience, which, again, you know, you watch these genre movies and a lot of them don't tell story and you don't have relationships with the characters and it's all about the kill and how badass it could be or the ride or the experience. And this really is, you know, this beautiful, kind of scary, horrible coming-of-age story that's kind of gorgeous. And it's weird that it, I mean, I always knew what it could look like, but seeing it in the theater when we screened it at TIFF was just like, it completely blew my mind. I knew it was good, but I love this movie so much.
It's a great movie, yeah. And I know exactly the scene you're talking about. And when you're talking about happy accidents, how often do those happen and how do you keep yourself open to them?
Oh, you know, I'm kind of an actress that the way I work is I don't really like to rehearse. I don't like, you know, when directors want to get together and have like a week of rehearsal before we shoot. I'm kind of anti that because I just feel like then I'm going to be remembering what I did in the room before and kind of have to pretend to have it be the same way. And I kind of just, for me, it's all about knowing how I feel about the person in that scene, and then the dialogue is just secondary, and whatever happens, happens. So I think it's A, trusting your director, trusting your co-star, and kind of trusting yourself that it could change, and it will change all the time. That every time I decide to do something, it never quite works out that way. It's like, I mean, I think that goes for every, I always feel like you want to make God laugh, tell him your plan. Like, life happens when you're busy making other plans. Like, you just, if you just let yourself be open to it, things kind of take care of themselves. Mm-hmm. And there's no real way to, like, decide how your day is going to go because it changes all the time. So I think that that's kind of how I approach the characters and the roles that I take. It's kind of the same way. It's kind of how I live my life, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you also mentioned the idea of family and kind of building relationships with the people you work with in the course of making a movie, and that translates into the screen if you do it right. And I mean, you going from film set to film set, is it difficult when a film ends because you do kind of form bonds with the people you work with in that short, intense kind of period of time?
I think why it may be different for me than maybe for people out of the genre is that I seem to work with the same people over and over and over again. So like every time I go to work, it's like the same people, you know, some different crew, but essentially like I'm about to do, I've just got like, I have two offers for two films right now that Bill Moseley is offered both of them and Kane has been offered one of them. So it's like, I know once those go, if they go, like I'll be going to work with Kane and Bill again. You know, going back on and doing another half or doing another, I'm not doing another Halloween, but like if I were to do another one, it'd be, you know, like Scout would be there again and Tyler would be there again. So it's kind of like, I'm really lucky to stay in this world because it's really, it's a teeny tiny little place that we live. So I get to keep, I get to continue these relationships and I talk to all these people all the time and doing conventions. So it's like, I get to see my friends constantly. I love that I get calls from William Forsythe when he comes into town because he wants to grab a drink. Like, I love that. I love that the next movie that I'm doing, Tony Todd brought me in on. It's one day of work. It shoots in Virginia. Tony's been wrapped for weeks now, but he's coming down to hang out with us. So it's like, we all kind of look out for each other. And I think that these roles are written for very specific, and a lot of times, you know, they're fanboys that are writing these movies anyway, so they write with, say, my face in their head when they're writing, or, you know, or Kane as the killer, or, you know, a Lance Henriksen or a Michael Biehn. Like, you kind of know who these people are if you love this world. So those will be who the offers go to first, and then I'll get to work with them. So and I keep up with those relationships. Like Jim, you know, Jim Mickel just came in to deliver the film last week, and he came over and we hung out and went and grabbed dinner and stuff. But I mean, he was at my house a couple months ago when I had to go out of town, and I was like, dude, you're not staying in a hotel. You're staying in my house. Stay in my house as long as you watch my dog. So we stayed in my house, watched my dogs, drove my car, slept in my, you know, slept in my room. Like, I was like, take my room. I'm gone. So this literally is family. I mean, to make these movies on these shoestring budgets, like, you got to get it real close real quick. And I think that's what we do.
Yeah. So in working so kind of quickly in the independent film realm, is it more pressured, or does it give you more kind of freedom because you're not second guessing yourself? You don't have the luxury of time or the money to kind of do that?
You know, I've been doing independent movies for most of my career. So when there's too much time, I kind of feel like something's wrong. I'm so used to having everything being fast and furious. I mean, even on film sets where I'm not having to be covered in blood, and I'm not crying all day, and I'm not coming home at 8 a.m. when the sun's coming up, I kind of don't know what to do with myself. Mm. I actually feel like I'm not doing enough work because I'm so used to having to work so hard emotionally and physically in these movies, but I don't really know how to do it any other way. I did an episode of Psych a couple months ago on USA, and it was like, I hadn't done TV in like 5 years. So for me to go onto a set where everything is just like a well-oiled machine, and they just knock it out, and we do a couple takes, and they know how to do it, and we move on, I just felt like, God, this is the easiest job in the world. I don't know if I would want my job to be that easy. I kind of feel like I have such an appreciation, and I'm so proud of it at the end of the day, because I know it's been blood, sweat, and tears, literally, in my case. And I kind of like it. It's like, people always ask, like, well, don't you want to do other things? And don't you want to break out of the genre? And to be honest, this is one of the hardest jobs, to carry a movie as a woman in this world. It's really hard. I'd love to see, I always say this, like, I'd love to see these actresses that are making, you know, $20 million a movie. I'd love to see them try to do what I do for $100 a day. I'd love to see them go to work without having a paycheck and have to be a complete freaking mess all day long and be good at it, because I'm not going to phone it in. I'm an actress. Like, if you guys are going to know, I watch these movies and I'm like, that girl did not care about being on set. She didn't. She just showed up to get her money. She did not. She was not invested. And I think that's kind of why, like, I talked to Adam Green the other day, and we were talking about the Scream Queen title. And I said to him, I go, why do you think I got that? Like, I don't know where that came from, except that I've done a lot of these movies. What do you think it is? And he said, Danielle, because you're really good. And I was like, whatever, I'm just doing my job. And he was like, no, you know what? You come to work every day really wanting to be there, no matter what it is. There's nothing I won't do. Rarely do I say, guys, I'm not doing it.
Right.
You know, I mean, I just did this movie called Shiver with John Jarrett, and I couldn't wait to do the stunt driving stuff. They had a stunt woman there, but I actually did it myself. And they were like, we don't even know why we brought her here, because you did it. And I was cracking up right before we were about to shoot every single time we did a take, because I was having so much fun getting my car slammed by a cop car. I thought it was the coolest thing in the world. You know, on a big movie, they're not going to let the actress do that. So for me, I'm like, yeah, I get to drive the car into a ditch. And then he gets to come bashing through the window, and I get to maybe have glass all over me. And then, you know, like, it's just, and I get to go home, just, I get to go to my trailer and have to wipe myself off with shaving cream because I'm covered in fake blood and my hair is stuck to my face. Like, I just think that's the coolest thing in the world. It's like another day at the office. It's a funny job I have, that's for sure.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, I've always said that the performance in horror films, or that genre, it's pretty much the most emotionally wrenching physical kind of performance you can give in any genre. I mean, it's got to be really taxing and difficult.
It's hard, I'll tell you. But I love it. I mean, it really makes me feel like I'm like that feeling after I do a really great scene where I get to have it be organic and can have it be real. I mean, listen, there are definitely times after 12 hours when I'm like, you guys, I need Visine just to get it started, because I really don't have anything left in me. But I'll be damned if it'll be the 12th hour until I finally ask for it, because I just want it. I just want to feel that. That's, you know, that's the heroin for an addict. Like, that's why we do what we do. It's not to have these, like, you know, easy conversation scenes. Like, I really want to get down and dirty, and I want to get in there, and I want to be able to flex my muscles and really work. Love it.
Right. Before I let you go, Hatchet 3 is happening?
Yeah, I'm actually looking at the cover of Variety, which is on my fridge right now, and there's a little picture of me in the shower with scratches on my face. but nonetheless, it is the cover of Variety. Yeah, you know, I just talked to Adam the other day. We did a press thing for UK for the DVD release there, and he said, yeah, Half to Three's happening, and, you know, Dark Skies is going to do it again, same producers, and Adam's in the middle of writing it. So I was like, you got to tell me, dude, because he's so secretive about stuff. I was like, just tell me are you going to kill me in the first act, you know? And he was like, well, here's the story. And I said, tell me what you've written so far. So he kind of told me, like, just little bits and pieces of what it is, and mm-hmm. I have no idea when we're going to shoot it. He's got so much going on right now that I think it's just when he has the time to do it, and he doesn't know if he's going to even be able to direct it. And I'm like, I know he's going to want to direct it.
Oh,
so
he better
direct it. I was like, I don't know if I want to do it if you don't direct it, even though he's going to definitely write it. I don't care what he says. I think he'll direct it. We just got to wait until he has some time to do it. So it could be in 2 months. It could be in December. I don't know when we're going to do it, but we're going to do it.
I mean, he set the bar so high with that second one. So
I know.
I'm very curious what he's got up his sleeve for this one.
Well, let's just say that it's going to be pretty damn awesome. He likes to top himself, so the third one will top the second one, that's for sure. And I'm for sure coming back.
Okay, that is Danielle Harris talking about Stakeland and hopefully an upcoming Hatchet 3 with Adam Green. It's her second appearance on our show.
Yeah, no, she's a great interview. She's wonderful.
Yeah, she's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Stakeland, April 22nd, and look for it on your on-demand systems, too, IFC, I believe. So the last time we were on air was last Sunday for the third episode of our Kubrick series, which covered A Clockwork Orange. And that day, it was announced that Sidney Lumet had passed.
Right.
Mm. And when I think of Sidney Lumet, I mean, even with the Before the Devil Knows You're Dead and the press that he would do for that, he just seemed endlessly energetic and
mm-hmm.
very sharp-minded and,
yeah.
you know, kind of ageless in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it was somewhat of a surprise to see that he had passed, and I was hoping for other movies from him.
Oh, totally, yeah. I mean, especially after the last couple. I like Find Me Guilty, too. So, I mean, that and Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, I'm like, wow. I mean, please,
yeah.
more, please. This is great.
Yeah, and for his last movie to be so cutting edge and kind
mm-hmm.
of edge of your seat and down and dirty.
Oh,
know?
Very down and dirty.
You know, and great performances, which if he had any kind of trademark, I mean, people called him a New York filmmaker, and I think he kind of scoffed at that he didn't feel a sense of community among the so-called New York filmmakers. But if he had any kind of commonality between his movies, it was in the performances and his love of actors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We did a tribute show to him in June of 2008 where we talked to four people that knew him and worked with him. And they were all extremely complimentary of him. One of the actors we talked to was Chris Sarandon, who, of course, was featured really prominently as Al Pacino's lover in Dog Day Afternoon. When I think Lumet, Dog Day Afternoon is my favorite.
Right.
But, you know, Dog Day, Serpico, Long Day's Journey in the Night, 12 Angry Men,
The Pawnbroker,
The Pawnbroker, The
yeah.
Verdict.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, it goes on and on. I mean, there's just so many great films. Night Falls on Manhattan, Critical Care.
Absolutely.
I mean, we go on and on. I mean, just an endless amount of The Hill, The Offense. I mean, I just go, you know, on and on, just how awesome a filmmaker he was.
So it was a great loss, you know,
mm-hmm.
to a certain very honest, very performance-rich style of filmmaking. Without,
right.
you know, without all the bells and whistles, he just
mm-hmm.
liked to tell stories with fascinating characters. And was there ever a more fascinating character than Pacino's in Dog Day Afternoon? I mean, that this guy really existed.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This war veteran who robbed a bank to pay for his lover's sex change operation.
Right.
He was married. I mean, it's a fascinating character, and it's one of those movies where you learn so much about him in the course of the movie, but not near enough. You feel like there's so much more to this character.
Mm-hmm.
He's a kind of a curiosity. But it could play it as such a joke.
Right.
It doesn't. It doesn't.
And also
Cazal in that movie.
Oh, Cazal is incredible. There's also another, like, Running on Empty, The Morning After.
Yes.
Prince of the City.
Yeah.
I mean, just so many great films. Just so many good ones.
Yeah, Running on Empty has always been a favorite of mine,
yeah,
too. And he always kind of, he liked that movie, but he said that was big-time melodrama, that it was sentimental.
Mm-hmm.
Which he generally liked to avoid.
Right.
So it seemed like he wasn't as crazy about that movie as I was. But gosh, I sure love that movie.
Mm-hmm. It's a great, it's a very good movie.
It's a great River Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great scene between Christine Lottie and her father in it.
Mm-hmm.
The emotional movie. And Network was very prescient. It was so much ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he shot it, and the way he shot it to look more and more flat and like television as the movie progressed, and
right,
degraded into a complete kind of television image at the
mm-hmm.
end of it with the lighting and everything. And again, like more Oscar wins and Oscar nominations for the performances in that
right.
movie. I mean, Faye Dunaway and Peter Finch, and just great, great
mm-hmm.
performances.
Wonderful, yeah.
Yeah. So if you want to listen to our tribute to Sidney Lumet, it is the featured show on Movie Geeks United. If you go to our homepage at blogtalkradio.com/Movie Geeks United, you can hear the tribute we did for him a couple of years ago with people that have worked with him. You all right?
Yeah, I'm fine. No, I just had something in my throat. Thank you, though. I appreciate your concern.
I'm genuinely concerned. So this is a mystery score. Here's a little two-minute piece of score. This is from a drama that came out back in 2003.
Okay.
So when it ends, I want your best guess with composer and title.
Okay.
This is a test.
Great.
Here we go. Okay.
I have no idea, but it's beautiful, whatever it is. But
You need a hint? I'll give you a hint.
Okay, well, God.
Here's the movie's tagline. Hang on. Read between the lies.
Oh, okay. Dun, 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 dun. I keep wanting to say The Life of David Gale.
Oh.
Because that was 2003, I remember. But,
Ah, this is a better movie.
Oh, okay.
Oh, well, that narrows it down.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, it really does help. No, you got to tell me. I mean, I sort of recognize it, but not enough that I can pinpoint it.
It stars Anakin Skywalker.
Oh, my God. Stained Glass. Okay.
Shattered Glass, yes.
Shattered Glass. I want to say Stained Glass. Like the Judas Priest album, yeah. Shattered Glass.
Yeah.
Wow. You got to forgive me. I don't remember. I haven't seen that in so long, but it's such a good movie. I like it.
Composed by Michael Dana, yeah. Yeah, great movie.
Mm-hmm.
Found the soundtrack at the store today, 99 cents. I was like, hell yeah.
What store? Where'd you go?
Hell to the Yes.
Oh, okay.
A place called Sound Exchange.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. So anyone that lives in the area, which no one out there does, go to Sound Exchange in Brandon.
No, that's a really good movie. He makes really good movies. Billy Ray, right? That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he makes some. And this is really good, too, because this came out right as the Jason Blair thing was going on. And, like, it was a very popular movie at the time. People were, like, really curious about it and what that guy did at the New Republic. Wow.
Yeah.
Good movie. Really good movie.
It's a great performance from Hayden Christensen, too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's
mm-hmm.
his best. His best performance so far. It's delicate. It's really a difficult role, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He has something coming out. He was in that movie Takers. Okay, all right. That was the last thing I think he was in. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, what is it in someone that would be that deceptive? You know, what is that defective in him?
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to hold it all together.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, for those that haven't listened yet, our Kubrick series episode 3 is available. Go to moviegeeksunited.net or on the page you're on now, go to the previous episode and you'll hear episode 3 talking about A Clockwork Orange with Malcolm McDowell and a few other guests. Our new website will be up next week. Moviegeeksunited.net has gotten a makeover.
Sweet.
So we're just programming the links and stuff so they all work. We're doing that now. So check in during the week. I suppose we may be back on when? Wednesday?
Wednesday, yeah. Wednesday would be the next time we would be on if we're going to be on. Yeah.
What is the date? What is today's date?
Today is the 17th, so that would be the 20th.
Okay. Because I'm waiting to hear back about a junket that takes place on the 25th. And that would be with Mark Ruffalo and Orlando Bloom and Laura Linney. So that might be a big show.
Right.
Up that following Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
But who knows?
We'll see. Keep your fingers crossed.
So let's end tonight with our final interview with Joan Benedict Steiger. She's been in the business for decades, both on stage and screen. And she is the widow of Rod Steiger. She was married to Rod Steiger before his death, and
mm-hmm.
she has wonderful memories of that relationship. So she talks about her career and her life with Rod Steiger in this brief interview, and that'll spell goodbye for us.
Okay.
For the show. Jerry.
All right.
It's been fun.
No, it's been a lot of fun. It was good. Very a lot of fascinating interviews so far. So. Sweet.
Jerry, I just want to say
hello.
Oh, hiya, Jerry. It's been a lot of fun. You know what we got to do again? We got to do that name that film score thing.
Yeah, we have all those people that want to compete in it, so.
Yeah.
We got to start that up again.
Yeah, we do. I'm running out of film scores. There's one right there, Shattered Glass, and you'll be able to get that one now.
Yeah, I'll be able to get that one. Great, I'll get it.
Yeah. All right, guys. Have a good evening. Here's Joan Benedict Steiger that we're leaving you with.
Oh.
That is how you started, isn't it, as a dancer?
Well, when I was 7, dancing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My first recital was at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in New York.
Oh, wow. Wow. And it's something that obviously has been a lifelong passion for you.
Oh,
you're
yes.
Obviously
now,
still
I'm
doing
talking
it.
About dance, I'm talking about tap dancing.
And tell me what dance does for you, what it expresses for
gosh.
You.
Oh, gosh, if I couldn't dance. I dance around the house when I'm not at my class. I'm dancing at the house. I'm dancing when I'm shopping. I'm just dancing all the time, moving. that's the way I started out. Actually, I started with my tap and my ballet. And my mother sent me to Rome in Italy, and I was a member of the Royal Opera Ballet School. And I soon found out I really wasn't, first of all, I didn't like it as much as my tap, and I wasn't physically suited. You really have to be built a certain way to be a ballet dancer.
Uh-huh.
It's really a physical construction because it's very much along the lines of acrobatics. When we started tapping and dancing and ballet and everything, acrobatics was a separate thing. And today, when you see the Broadway dancers, and they are just the leaping and everything, they're all Baryshnikovs. It's all combined. It's very, very acrobatic. It's incredible. I soon decided tap was my my love, and I've been dancing ever since.
Well, when I think about dance, I think about the enormous discipline involved, the aspect where you're very aware of your body and your physicality. Obviously, I would think that those traits are important in acting too.
Oh, absolutely. Dedication is number one. And while you might not be physically hurt unless you're doing stunts or something, but your ego can be bruised a lot. So I soon decided most of my energies then were into acting, and I started my acting classes in my teens, and then I got my first television job when I was just about 18 on the Steve Allen Show.
Mm. And you studied, actually, did you study at the Actors Studio? Or?
I studied with the founders of the Actors Studio. I studied with Robert Lewis, the genius. He and Stella Adler, I studied with Stella Adler, master classes, and then I've been a member of four different theater groups, all top theater groups. So, and I am now expecting to receive an award on the 24th from the Los Angeles Women's Theater Festival. For all the plays I've done. I can't believe I've done about 40 plays.
I just wanted to ask about Stella Adler, because we've had several guests over the years that studied under Stella, and they just rave, superlatives. What did you get from her, from Stella?
Well, of course, they all probably told you she wasn't, she didn't like women too well. But I did one day I had done a specific scene. She didn't say anything. I didn't get any compliments, and everybody was telling me afterwards how great. And as I was walking out of class, after class was over, she grabbed my arm and she said, "Brava." Mm. So that's the way she was.
Yeah. And
she was quite incredible. Formidable.
And when you looked early on in your career for possibly role models in the world of acting, who fit that bill for you?
Barbara Stanwyck. That's my favorite actress. Barbara Stanwyck. The directors all said she was such a favorite of all the directors. They said, "Well, just turn the camera on and she does it all in one take." She was fabulous. Her comedy was great, and her drama, and I just loved her. I know most of the girls love Bette Davis. I do, too. But it's just my preference. It's something about Barbara. Also, Barbara's a dancer. She started out dancing.
And you've been acting for many years.
I've been
married, actually. I've been married twice, and then I did live with a wonderful love for 4 years, and each one of them taken away by cancer, different cancers.
Yeah.
Every time I was, like, right at the epitome of my acting career, I got married. So everything kind of got interrupted, but I'm not sorry for anything. I've had the greatest loves in my life. So just a real actor. Now, Rod, my husband Rod Steiger, was a true actor. So many times scripts would be delivered, and if he didn't see anything that he liked, or it wasn't a concept that he believed in, because he was a man of his own conscience and everything, he would not do it. So he said, of course, he's told the story many times, which you probably know, that one of the films that he turned down was Patton. That was one of his big mistakes in his career. He was offered it, and he didn't believe in war, and he turned it down, and of course he had regrets after that.
Did he regret that decision?
Yes, because he said if he had done Patton, he would have been right into The Godfather.
Well, such a legendary actor, and one of the great visceral, he had such a presence on screen.
Oh, yes.
There was a power
on
to
the screen.
Him.
Yes. I don't think there's anybody like him. If he's on the screen, you're looking at him. He was a real movie actor. Now, not telling tales out of school, he didn't like theater. He was frightened of theater. He had such a tremendous regard for me. Doing plays. I met him at the time in New York when I was a kid, and he was doing Rashomon on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't meet him at Rashomon. I met him because we did a TV show together, and we were in the makeup room, and he said, "Come over here, kid." And he invited me to see Rashomon. I went to see Rashomon. We were crossing Broadway, and there was a big marquee, Rod Steiger starring in Al Capone. And I remember crossing Broadway with him. I said, "Oh, my gosh, how does it feel? You're starring on Broadway in a play and then in the movies." He said, "Great, kid."
So it was almost like fate, because he contacted you many, many years later, around 1990 or so.
Oh, yes, yeah. Well, I had met my three gods in New York at the same time when I was a kid and starting out. And we were dating, and then I got really busy, and I was on Candid Camera, and they wanted me to star as a regular. And then, so I had met Rod, and he had to come back to California to do some movie shooting. And then I met my husband. It was on the Jack Parr show and stuff. So I married John, and then I was married for 30 years. And when we were in California, John had passed away and everything. So just jumping forward, I got a call, and this is Joan Benedict. Yes, this is Rod Steiger. I nearly fell over.
Wow.
And I don't know, they heard about me something. At a party or something, and and so we were together, maybe 3 years, and then he proposed marriage, and we traveled all over the world, and I made two films with him.
Yes.
And then after a while, he died. So.
Well, I understand that. Maybe I'm mistaken, but when I think of his work, it's such a brilliant body of work. Just one powerful performance after another, but the images from The Pawnbroker always come to my mind. Was that a particular favorite of his?
That was his favorite.
Yeah.
That was his big favorite. Absolutely.
Stunning.
And he used to
movie.
Say people would come up to him and thought it was a foreign movie because it was done in such a realistic style. And he was only like about 30 years old when he did that. Yeah.
Mm. Mm.
So think, if I'm not mistaken, when he was offered on the waterfront to play Marlon Brando's brother, Sidney Lumet, that was his first big movie after, after The Pawnbroker.
Wow.
No, Sidney Lumet didn't direct. Sidney Lumet directed The Pawnbroker, and then
Kazan
directed, on the waterfront.
They really don't make movies like that anymore.
No,
It's a cliche. It's a cliche to say that, but it's absolutely true. So with you, now are you still doing theater? You're receiving an award next month. You said.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
That's with theater, and then I've been doing a lot of host work for KCET. I did the first big spring fundraiser for them on KCET on Saturday, and I'm going to have a little small my tap dancing recital on the 27th, and I'm waiting for my movie to be finished. It's in post-production, Dead Border.
Okay. And tell me about that project.
Yeah, I can't tell you too much because then it's a mystery. And,
okay.
I play Dr. Barnes, which is a very pivotal role in the movie because they're going to do a sequel, and then it comes out who I really am. it has a lot to do with forensic labs and dead bodies and things. Yeah.
Well, before I let you go, just one more question about theater and film.
Mm-hmm.
The different kinds of muscles that both of those mediums work for you, how do they differ?
Well, really different. I just love to be on stage. I love the theater. I just, I'm, very animated and move a lot and everything, and I just always feel constricted by cameras. I don't know.
Right.
I'm not a, even by my computer, I'm definitely not a machine person. But I would love to have a series, a TV series.